Plato. Welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. 35 years ago, during the first Earth Day, we were focused on very local environmental issues, polluted rivers catching fire, toxic waste dumps, cleaning up the litter along the highways. And while Joni Mitchell sang about paving paradise to put up a parking lot, the global impact of environmental destruction was not really on our radar screen. We were occupied with our own backyards. But that slogan of Earth Day, think global, act local, has been given renewed meaning and urgency today in the form of two massive United Nations reports which focus on global issues, the Earth and its ecosystems and environment, with solutions that are local. The first report, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, compiled the work of over 1,300 scientists. It takes stock of what nature supplies us with, what we are using, misusing, disturbing, and what the outcome of our human activity might be. One of its starkest conclusions? Human activity is putting such a strain on the natural functions of Earth, on our water supply, trees, rivers, and oceans, that the ability of the planet's ecosystems to sustain future generations can no longer be taken for granted. A second report with a similar sounding name, the Millennium Project Task Force on Environmental Sustainability, reaches many of the same conclusions, but it offers some recommendations on how governments can turn things around. We're going to be talking about both of these reports this hour on this Earth Day 2005. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, I invite you to give us a call. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Don Melnick is the Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation and Professor of Conservation Biology at Columbia University in New York. He served as the co-chair of the Millennium Project Task Force on Environmental Sustainability, and he joins us here in our New York studio. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Melnick.
It's nice to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Carmen Ravenga is a senior freshwater scientist at the Nature Conservancy. She served as one of the coordinating lead authors for the UN Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and she joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Ravenga.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Watson is the chief scientist at the World Bank. He's also director of the Environmentally and Socially Sustainable Development Network there, and he served as the board co-chairperson for the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. He was involved with the second report as well, and he joins us today from Rome. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Watson.
It's a pleasure.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Watson. The theme of these reports is that many of us view nature as only something to be enjoyed on weekends, you know, but we're failing to see how nature plays a part in our everyday lives. And if we don't wake up, we're not going to have much of that nature around to support us. How does nature support us in our everyday lives besides from just being a nice place to take a walk in?
Yes, in very many ways. First, it provides us what we call provisioning services. It provides us with food, clean water, energy, medicines. It helps to regulate our climate, our air quality, our water quality. It regulates storm surges. It also sustains us through soil formation, pollination services. And it has value, as you say, aesthetically, has religious value, sort of sacred forest. It has tourism value. And so nature provides us goods and services that are absolutely essential for human well-being.
Mm-hmm. And it's these goods and services that have been under attack over the years now.
Yes, there's been positive and negatives. Over the last 50 years, we've tried to maximize our so-called provisioning services. More food, more livestock, more fish, more energy. And unfortunately, as we've tried to maximize these, it's undermining some of these other important services. It's undermining our ability to clean our air, clean our water, provide pollination services. It's undermining our ability for soil formation, the way we recycle our nutrients. And so while we've got more food today, we can put that as a big plus. Although even though we've been trying to maximize our production food, there are still 800 million people in the world hungry. There's still 2 billion people that don't have clean water. So while we've had some successes, we are still not meeting the basic human needs of clean water, energy, food that we really need.
So back in June of 2001, Kofi Annan of the UN said, let's take some time and it's the millennium, let's evaluate, let's assess the world's ecosystems now, and so this Millennium Ecosystem Assessment came about?
Yes, exactly. And effectively, as you've already pointed out, we put over 1,350 experts together. We had it peer-reviewed by an additional 900 individuals. And we made sure that the experts were from all walks of life, people from government, people from universities, local NGOs, people from international organizations like the World Bank. We made sure the big international conventions on biodiversity, on wetlands, on desertification were all involved. We made sure the private sector was involved. Mm. In other words, we wanted a process where everybody would own the process and therefore would realize that we all have to act. Governments, individuals, private sector, etc.
And you didn't come, and the results don't sound very encouraging.
Well, you could argue, is a glass half full or is a glass half empty? I'd like to say it's half full. That is to say, business as usual is unacceptable. If we continue the way we manage our ecosystems today, we're going in the wrong direction. But what we point out is there's many things that can be done by governments, by the private sector, by individuals that will allow us to provide these goods and services we need for human well-being and at the same time have a much more sustainable set of ecosystems. So there's many actions that can be taken, but we do have to act.
Let's talk about some of the things you found. Carmen Ravenga, you coordinated the parts of the report that looked at freshwater resources. What did you find there?
Well, we found that, unfortunately, we're not doing very well at managing our freshwater resources around the world. There are definitely some countries that are okay, like Norway. They have plenty of water. And as you know, water is a very local issue. But for most of the people in the world, and particularly the poor, we are really not meeting their needs. There, as Bob mentioned, there are 1.1 billion people without safe drinking water, and there are 2.6 billion without access to basic sanitation. And this is increasing. So it's quite urgent. We really need to rethink the policies and practices that we have in place.
Mm-hmm. Don Melnick, how does your project differ from the other UN project? And what are the, the positive differences about it?
As Bob was just saying, that the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment involved about 1,350 scientists, and it really was engaged in a four-year, very detailed assessment by experts in many of the different areas one would need to have to make this kind of assessment. The Millennium Project Task Force on Environmental Sustainability that, interestingly enough, Bob Watson also sat on, that task force, was really not so much focused on the assessment part, but how do you take the information from the assessment and how do you sort of whittle that down to a set of recommendations that you can present to nations so that they have some kind of a blueprint, some kind of a roadmap for trying to achieve sustainability in all of these critical areas that we were just talking about. Sustainability in the production of food, sustainability in the productivity of the fisheries, sustainability in soils, sustainability in fresh water. I mean, just to give you an example, about 70% of the fresh water that we use on the surface of the earth is used for agriculture. It does not end up in the mouths of people around the world, whether they're poor or rich. That kind of inefficiency and the amount of water that's being used in agriculture for that is essentially draining many of the surface water that we have in rivers and streams, as well as groundwater that we have. And this is a critical issue because water probably will be the most limited natural resource in the 21st century.
And so you came up with 10 key recommendations. Give us an idea of what some of the major recommendations were.
That's a very interesting question, because I think if you step back from the recommendations just to look at one key sentence we had in the report, and that is that environmental sustainability is essential to achieving all other Millennium Development Goals. This Millennium Project actually grew out of the Millennium Summit in 2000, where the heads of state all came to New York City. Most people remember that summit only because traffic was tied up for an entire week in the city. Yeah. But in fact, heads of state came and they came up with a Millennium Declaration where they laid out eight different goals. And those goals were dealing with hunger and poverty and water and sanitation and disease and gender equality and environmental sustainability. What we argue in this action plan, so to speak, that we've created is that environmental sustainability is at the foundation, that we are not going to be able to achieve sustainable solutions to hunger and poverty and water and sanitation and disease unless we deal with this progressive degradation of the environment, that those other issues are very important and they need to be dealt with right now, but those other issues are more symptoms of the larger problem, which is environmental degradation. So we, rather interestingly, I think a lot of individuals involved in biodiversity conservation were really quite surprised with this report because they say, you know, I don't find any biodiversity in this. Well, that's not really true. It's just that we're looking at this in a broader perspective, the perspective that most humans come to the environment. I think if we're talking about the environment in terms of as you mentioned before, it's a nice place to go, a mm-hmm. great place to see birds. That's, you know, all the people that were going to buy it that buy this issue that way have already bought it. Now we're dealing with the 999 right. others out of 1,000, and so we really deal with very, very basic issues that people are facing. We talk about improving small-scale agriculture so it is more sustainable and less polluting. We talk about promoting forest management not only to sustain the forests and protect the forests, but also as a source of revenue and as a source of economic development. We talk about threats to freshwater sources, pollution. It's, I think, extremely instructive to note that how the world was, and I was, when I was on your show last time, we were talking about the tsunami and how the world galvanized around the effects of the tsunami, a terrible, terrible event in which 250,000 people died. Well, 250,000 people die every month because of chemical and biological pollution of water, every month and every year. And yet there's rarely any focus on that kind of an impact. This is a real human impact.
Dr. Watson, Don Melnick has talked about poverty as being one of the roots of the problem here in the world. What can the World Bank do, environmentally speaking, to solve some of these environmental issues?
Yes, what all of these reports are saying, the environmental degradation, where it's loss of biodiversity, land degradation, water pollution, climate change, it all primarily affects poor countries most and poor people most. What the bank can do is to try and make sure that we have the twin approach of economic growth and a clean environment. There's no dichotomy between having economic growth and a clean environment. There are some trade-offs, but we have to understand them well. So what the bank can do is several things. We can try and make sure that our client countries have some of the very best technologies available that are environmentally friendly, whether they're in agriculture or in energy production and energy use. We find that land tenure, that people that have rights to their land, look after their land and wise stewardship. The bank has been promoting for a long while land tenure policies to encourage local people to take a long-term view. We can actually encourage governments to be less sectoral. That is to say, you need the Environment Ministry to work with the Energy Ministry, with the Transportation Ministry, with the Agriculture Ministry and the Forest Ministry. They can't all work separately. And so we have to what we would call integrate environmental concerns in all sectors. So it's not just the role for the Environment Minister. It's equally important the Finance Minister understands the role of environment. And we have to get the economics right. We have to get rid of perverse subsidies in agriculture and energy and transportation and fisheries that are leading to environmental degradation, and the bank has been promoting this a lot. We also have to recognize that there's value in these ecological services, and we've got this new concept, not just the bank, but many accounts, payment for ecological services. We need to pay the person that's got a forest to maintain that forest, because if you destroy the forest, you get the value of the wood, but that forest is so much more valuable. Timber there, there's carbon that's stored there that helps protect the climate system. If you maintain the forest, it saves you having runoff and sedimentation into the water system. It also can be good in certain places for ecotourism, non-timber forest products. So what we're learning is what are all the values of a forest system and how do we capture those values to make sure that a person that has a forest land wants to maintain it, not destroy it. And what the bank's really pushing very hard, because we believe climate change is a very serious environmental issue, both globally and locally, is what we call a carbon market. We're trying to sort of work methods to get clean technologies throughout the world to make sure that we do basically limit the greenhouse gases that are going into the Earth's atmosphere. We don't want developing countries to pay more for their energy production, but we are trying to find ways to make it clean energy.
Well, that brings up a very interesting point, because the new head of the World Bank, Paul Wolfowitz, comes from the United States, whose president is not really very interested in the global warming issue. I mean, he has said that scientists have said, you know, global warming is a real threat. He's called them part of the bureaucracy. Are you going to become part of the bureaucracy of the World Bank if you raise these issues with Paul Wolfowitz?
I honestly don't know. I mean, Paul Wolfowitz has now a very different job. He will indeed be the president of the World Bank, and the goal of the World Bank is to have economic development, is to help poor people, and it's to be environmentally and socially sustainable. So the fact he came from, indeed, the current administration does not mean to say that when he gets to the World Bank that he will not have a different perspective on this. And so I would hope that he would indeed recognize the importance of environmental issues generally, such as climate change, such as loss of biodiversity, land degradation, how they affect poor people, how they affect poverty, how they affect human health. And so I've never personally met him, but I do believe that this will have to be, these will be issues that clearly will face Mr. Wolfowitz when he becomes the president of the World Bank.
1-800-989-8255. Don, any reaction to...
No, I'd like to add and underscore something that Bob said. I think, you know, one of the problems is we use this term sustainable development. It's used all the time. It's a very vague term which can encompass virtually anything, and therefore I think it really means nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think what these reports are really saying is that we have to put the E words back in sustainable development. It should be environmentally sustainable economic development. That's really what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And as Bob was just saying, these are not in conflict with environmental sustainability and economic development are not in conflict with each other, as long as you consider the fact that there will be trade-offs. And it's also the case that it's highly unlikely you're going to have long-term economic growth unless you do have environmental sustainability. There are strong economic reasons for doing this. And, you know, there are already examples of this going on. If you go to Costa Rica, for instance, the operators, these are private sector operators of dams who provide hydroelectric power, are now paying farmers upstream to not convert their forests into farmland but leave them in forest. Why? Because the biggest problem that dams have is that they silt up. The soil comes off into the streams, mm-hmm. silts up the dam. The next thing you know, the dam's life is half of what you planned it to be. Now, you just invested a lot of money in the dam. So it actually makes economic sense for them to give farmers money to not cut down the forest and have a longer life for their dam. They pass that on in the price anyway in terms of the electricity they generate.
But Costa Rica gets it already. I mean, they've been environmentally, you know, savvy with ecotourism, all kinds of things. They understand there's money to be made. What about the countries that you have to talk into? Who are going to be your biggest challenges to convince that that economically speaking, they can come out on the you know, the black side of the ledger here?
Yeah, I think that actually the experiences that we've had, and we've actually it's been very interesting. One of the things I said when we released this document is that the usual life history of a document like this is that it's released,
right.
Everyone reads it, then it goes on a shelf to die. We're trying to prevent that from happening. So what we have been doing is approaching the heads of state of countries, the ministers of environment, and also the other more powerful ministers within those countries. Mm-hmm. I have been amazed at the reception that we have received. Even last night, I was talking to the Minister of the Environment of a number of different countries that you would not necessarily expect to sign on to this, and they have. And the reason for it is I think that you're seeing more and more of an understanding of what the economic issues are, the long-term economic issues and growth issues are associated with a degrading environment. And all I have to say is look at the most recent issue of The Economist. There are two big articles all about this. When it reaches the pages of The Economist and it is talked about in such positive terms, I think we're getting the picture that people are starting to get this.
Bob Watson, do you agree?
Yes, and in fact, it's very important we don't just speak to environmental ministers. We need to get to finance ministers. In general, they're very powerful in their governance. We have to demonstrate there's economic value in sustaining our environment. We need to get to the energy minister. When they decide about extraction of energy or use of energy, there's an environmental footprint. How do we bring those two together? How do we produce and use energy in a clean way? So the key here is not just working with environment ministers, but working with all the various ministers. And I think we're starting to make progress. But the private sector is equally important. The private sector is very powerful. And I think now they mostly recognize the so-called triple bottom line. They need to make a profit for their shareholders, but they also realize they do need to be environmentally and socially sustainable. So our message is not only to governments, but equally it's to the private sector as well. They're major players.
Yeah, got to convince the World Economic Forum to take it under their advisement when they have a symposium. Carmen Ravenga, let's go for a reality check back to some of the facts and the data, because one of the interesting assessments was how terrible the state of the world's fisheries is. It's just amazing how the fish are gone.
Yeah, it's not that new. I guess it's new to general public, mm-hmm. but overfishing has been a problem even back in the 1930s in the North Atlantic. But now it's spread to the rest of the world. We have become really good at catching fish and finding fish and processing out in open oceans. So it's become a global problem, and now more than 50% of the wild stocks are overfished and not showing any signs of recovery.
Yeah, and that was the interesting part, that if you stop the fishing, they don't come back. We thought they'd come back, right?
They can come back. They can come back, and they do come back at times. Like Namibia and New Zealand have very good management quotas in place, and they have reduced the fleets, and they actually have come back. But there's some, like the cod stocks of the Grand Banks, that have not come back, and they've been closed for some time since 1992 when the industry collapsed. But they haven't come back because, well, cod are special fish. They move a lot, and we catch them outside the no-take zones and things like that.
Right. Let me ask all three of you, what about the developing 800-pound gorillas in the world, China and India? Are they part of this problem? Do they understand the impact?
I've been very impressed with China. China, actually, I think there's a great opportunity and hope there because, for example, the Yellow River, the second largest river in China that has 150 million people, between 1972 and 1999, the river ran dry every year except for 6 years because of over-extraction of water for crops and industry. It's a hugely polluted river. And actually, in 2002, the Chinese Ministry of Water Affairs start thinking of maintaining environmental flows for the river, realizing that if you don't maintain the river alive, you're not going to have water for the people. And he passed very tough legislation, and the river has been with water, minimum flows, but with water, so it's a show of hope. And they're actually taking a look at ecosystem services and rethinking the way they manage water across China, which is a huge deal for a country like China. And as Dan and Bob had mentioned, actually the private sector role is very important because in southern China, the electricity companies, the provincial electric companies that are creating all these dams are the ones that really have to step in and play a more active role in environmental management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me make a comment. This is Bob. China is going to be absolutely critical. It not only has major issues to deal with internally, but it will have a massive regional and global footprint. It's got some of the strongest economic growth in the world, and it's got a large population. They realize they have very low per capita natural resources, whether it's water, whether it's arable land. And so in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, they came to us and said, we would like to do a Western China ecosystem study, because we do want to develop in Western China, and we need to understand how can we develop in an environmentally and economically sustainable manner. So the Chinese do fully realize that there is an internal footprint. Equally, given that one of the key issues for poverty alleviation and economic growth is use of energy, one of the big challenges will be in the future, how does China continue to produce its energy in a way that is environmentally clean? Because their footprint on carbon emissions are actually quite profound. Per person, they're only 1/9 of an average American. But given the population size, they're one of the largest emitters in the world. And so the development of the energy system in China will have profound global implications.
And from initial results, does it look like they're going toward nuclear energy so that there would be cleaner, you know, fewer emissions? Or does it look like they're going to stick with coal?
No, they certainly are making an investment in nuclear energy. One of our biggest challenges is to ask a simple question. Can we continue to use fossil fuels such as coal, and they have huge reserves of coal, without polluting the atmosphere? And there's a technology that is being developed now where we call it carbon capture and storage. That is to say, even though we use fossil fuels, we try and capture the carbon dioxide before it's emitted into the atmosphere. We liquefy it, and then we try and subduct it or store it in depleted oil wells, depleted gas wells. And so I'm optimistic that this type of technology may prove to be both economically viable and environmentally sound. And so I don't believe nuclear in any country in the world is going to be the solution. We have to produce our energy with a range of technologies that's cleaner, and we have to use it much wiser. So energy efficiency, whether it be in cars, whether it be in buildings, whether it be in industry, is going to be an equally important part of the equation.
Don, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing, because we've been talking mostly about what China is doing internally, but we should realize that China is a very large country, has a lot of mouths to feed and a lot of wood it needs for construction. And its footprint, its impact outside of China has been enormous on forests. Forests in two different ways. One, in extracting wood and buying the wood that's being extracted and importing a lot of wood from outside the country, but in another very big way, and that is China's food production really sort of topped off about 2 years ago, and it's not producing as much food as it needs as its population grows. So therefore, it's gone outside the country, and it is really searching for other places where soybeans and other kinds of food staples can be grown. This is having a big impact on Brazil, as Brazil converts more and more of its southern Amazon into the growing soybeans. So it's not only what's going on inside the country, it's what's going out. And what I would like to say about this is not to look at it as one of these big problems and as an enemy, but it really is going to have to be China is going to have to be a major part of the solution toward environmental sustainability. India is going to have to be a major part of the solution. In this hemisphere, Mexico and Brazil, these are four very big economies. They have high levels of education, they have high levels of technology, and they really can be part of the solution. And I think they probably want to be part of the solution. So I think, you know, it's really time for everyone to draw together and try to be.
You left out the U.S. Are they not part of the solution? I mean, do they want to be part of the solution, or do we have to talk the U.S. into this?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on who you talk to in the United States.
I mean, clearly the conspicuously absent, you know.
Yeah, well, clearly the United States is the number one emitter of carbon into the atmosphere.
Right.
So if you're talking about global warming, but it's important to note, which very few people realize, is that every year there's about 25 million acres of tropical forest that's cut down. That level of deforestation and land conversion emits into the atmosphere almost an equivalent amount of carbon as emitted by the United States. That is a huge part of the problem. And so just looking at the United States is really not the whole problem. We have to look at that land conversion, rampant land conversion, and its impact on emitting carbon into the atmosphere.
And they're going to have the desire to be part of that then.
But we have something like the Kyoto Protocols, which in terms of tropical forested countries has a negative incentive, because there is no money to be made by keeping your land in forest based on how the Kyoto Protocols are structured at the moment. And at current prices for a ton of carbon sequestered that you can get in emission trading schemes in the European Union, all of this tropical forest around the world is capturing an enormous amount of carbon. And if it were in one of these countries where you could trade it, it would be worth an enormous amount of money. Someone has calculated that the amount of carbon drawn down, right, in all of these tropical forests would be worth somewhere between $60 and $70 billion a year, which is equivalent to the amount of overseas development assistance that those developing countries get. So they are, in a sense, actually giving a subsidy to the rest of the world by keeping those forests in forest. But they get no return.
All right. Well, we're going to have to revisit this issue. Very good point. I want to thank my guests, Don Melnick, Carmen Ravenga, and Robert Watson, for joining us and talking about this really on Earth Day today. We're just beginning to scratch the surface. Thanks for listening. If you think Science Friday is good online, check us out on the air. Visit sciencefriday.com for a list of public radio stations that carry Science Friday on the radio. I'm Ira Flatow. We'll see you next time.